Turkey shoots down a Russian warplane. Brussels remains on lockdown. How global security fears are reshaping domestic politics. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we're joined by political analysts Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College and Hans Hassel of Cornell College. We'll ask them about the political impact, both here and abroad, of what amounts to perhaps the biggest direct confrontation between Russia and NATO since the Cold War. Also, how national security fears are reshaping the 2016 presidential race. Join our conversation on this Politics Day. First, this hour's news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer on this pre-Thanksgiving edition of Politics Day. We have Wayne Moyer joining us, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Wayne, hello to you.
Hi, Ben.
And Hans Hassel, Assistant Professor of Politics at Cornell College. Hello to you, Hans.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And we want to welcome our listeners this hour. Our focus is on politics here and abroad, mostly how the threats from abroad, the developing crisis, war in Syria, and the attacks in Paris have reshaped or are shaping our politics. Now that we're a few days away from those attacks in Paris, we're seeing other developments. We'd like to join our conversation. What are your questions do you have about the war against ISIS? And have national security worries reshaped your attitude towards our domestic politics, toward the presidential race, now that we're just over 2 months in front of the Iowa caucuses? And we'll share a little bit later in the hour some new Quinnipiac poll numbers for both of the major parties' candidates. But first of all, let's talk a little bit about this shoot down of a plane today. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov called Turkey's decision to shoot down the Russian Su-24 warplane that crossed over Turkish airspace a pre-planned provocation, but played down any speculation that Moscow is seeking to escalate this international incident. "We have serious doubts," Minister Lavrov said, "that this was an unintended incident. It looks very much like a pre-planned provocation. We do not plan to go to war with Turkey. Our attitude toward the Turkish people has not changed." Yesterday, Vladimir Putin in Sochi, Russian president, had words to say about it as well.
Сегодняшняя потеря связана с ударом, который нам нанесли в спину пособники террористов.
But today's event is the blow that has been given to us in our back by the accomplices of terrorists.
По-другому я не могу квалифицировать то, что сегодня случилось.
Vladimir Putin in his remarks there, the shoot down characterized as a stab in the back, so to speak. Wayne, talk about this. What are your reactions to it? What is, I guess, mainly, what is Turkey signaling with this shoot down? Repeated warnings before this happened.
Well, I think the background of this, there's a little finger of Turkey that sticks down into Syria. And the people that are living right in that area of Syria are of Turkish descent. And the Russians have been bombing them. And they're opposed to Assad. And in going across that area, it's quite likely a Russian plane crossed over into Turkey. The Turkish obviously saw that as a violation of their sovereignty. All of this follows on. There have been a number of Russian provocations across Western Europe in recent months of doing war games, flying over NATO territory. This can also be seen in that context of Russia trying to be provocative, and here Turkey is responding.
One of our listeners, John, wants to know what is the aim here of the provocations on the borders, close to borders or going over to borders? This has been increasing over months, if not years, under Vladimir Putin.
I think this is Putin trying to get a larger role for Russia in terms of international politics. I also think it plays very well at home, Russia looking strong in the world, showing that it has military capabilities.
Mm-hmm. Does either Turkey or Russia have interest here in escalating this, or more interest in playing it down? I'm wondering how you're interpreting the remarks by both the Turkish and the Russian leaders.
My sense is both sides want to play it down. But Russia has now put this advanced anti-missile system or anti-aircraft system in its bases in Syria. Apparently, they can go a couple of hundred miles. So I worry about further accidents. Russians might shoot a Turkish plane down, although neither side wants this to get out of control. The fact that there are planes flying around here at very high speeds and very limited territory is potentially problematic.
Hans Hassel, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a classic example of multiple nations wanting to have an influence and having an interest in the outcome of the ongoing conflict in Syria, and they're trying to sway that without getting entangled too much with each other. And this is, as a result, you have these conflicts the real battle is in Syria, but you have all these supporting nations that are have different interests at different levels, and this just happened to be a casualty as a result of that.
Mm-hmm. The coalition that President Obama has spoken of, others, this coalition in the making, doesn't this point out, Wayne, that it's not agreed who the enemy is? When you look through a Russian lens, they see a different enemy than the West does?
Yeah, I think this is a real problem. Clearly, for the United States, you're not going to get a solution to this problem until the Assad regime goes. And for the Russians, preserving the Assad regime seems to be their primary goal at this stage of the game. And it's going to be very difficult to get any kind of lasting cooperation as long as you have that difference.
1-866-780-9100. Have your questions about the war against ISIS, the latest developments. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Karen, one of our listeners, asks, why does Turkey allow ISIS to move through its border, Wayne?
I think the problem now is that Turkey really doesn't have really good border controls. It's a very, very long border with Syria. Turkey has, and it's an easy border to cross, and Turkey is not able to completely control the border.
Mm-hmm. Okay. 1-866-780-9100. Let's also talk a little bit about yesterday at the White House, President Obama and French President Francois Hollande promising to increase cooperation and expand attacks at the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. Here's what some of what the president had to say yesterday.
Today, President Hollande and I agreed that our nations must do even more together. U.S. assistance has supported recent French strikes in Syria, and we're going to keep stepping up that coordination. And as we saw with the attack in Mali, the terrorist threat goes beyond ISIL. This week, I'll sign legislation to sustain our support, including airlift and intelligence, to allies like France as we work together to root out terrorist networks in Africa. We'll do even more to prevent attacks at home. Building on our recent intelligence agreement, the United States will continue to quickly share threat information with France. And in the wake of Paris and with the threats in Belgium, there's also a growing recognition among European nations that they need to ramp up additional efforts to prevent the flow of foreign terrorist fighters.
President Obama yesterday there in his press conference beside French President Hollande. Wayne Moyer, what did you take away from this meeting? What do you see being communicated and worked on?
Well, we clearly wanted – Obama clearly is trying to show his support for the French after the bombing. It is not clear to me how much or in what ways he is going to escalate the U.S. commitment to fighting ISIS. it appears to me that he's going to stay very much with the bombing strategy. He seems very much opposed to putting troops on the ground. He seems to be opposed to establishing no-fly zones. I think he's still very concerned about getting the United States involved in a ground war, another ground war in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Hans Hassel, talk about that. What is the sentiment here at home? We've had very long wars, Afghanistan, the longest war in U.S. history, that we have several thousand troops still there, Iraq, in the mess that it is. So how do we judge the sentiment here for what many are saying is a call to an all-out war?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you've had recent experience in the last decade that has suggested that politically, wars are not a good long-term strategy for the party in power. And so I think that Democrats have that in mind, especially the Democratic policymakers. I think that you compare the opinions of those policymakers with the opinions of Americans, which are generally a little bit more pliable and are more reactionary to current events. You're going to see a slight disconnect there. Support for increased engagement is there, but I think that the Democratic policymakers are concerned about the long-term consequences that such actions might have on the brand of their party and their ability to win elections in the future.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, what are your thoughts as well as how national security is reshaping our politics approximately 2 months ahead of the Iowa caucuses amidst these daily reports of our world struggling to avoid escalating conflicts on multiple continents, security fears back to the top of voters' minds. Wayne, what do you see happening here when we look at the candidates?
Well, it's strengthening those who appear strong and appear tough. I'm afraid that in the short term, it's strengthened Donald Trump a little bit. I think it's also interestingly strengthened Chris Christie a little bit, although he's far weaker. I think the Republicans in general are taking a tougher line, the sense the public is responsive to the security threat, in hopes that that will help them.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the refugee question continues on. Some 30 governors, U.S. governors, saying that they would not want the Syrian refugees in their state, including Iowa's governor, Terry Branstad, said he would be open to the idea if Congress passed a bill tightening security measures. But Secretary of State John Kerry sending a lengthy letter to all governors detailing the tough screening procedures for the immigrants, a 4.5-page letter detailing, evidently, the type of refugees who receive priority, families, victims of torture, children. Those are the priorities when it comes to receiving refugees in the United States. And he described the multiple screening steps of refugees before they get to come to this country. He's saying it is the most robust screening process of any category of individuals seeking admission to the United States. Additional precautions have been added with regard to Syrian refugees sent to 30 governors. Hans, how do you see this playing out with the governors not quite on board with this? Is this are there real concerns here when we hear about the process that any refugees have to go through, or is this a political statement?
I think this is very much a political statement. So I had a class this morning on federalism, and we were talking about the different responsibilities that the national government has and state governments have. And this is a classic example of federalism. Who has control over immigration policy or refugee policy, right? That's very clearly the national government, right? We've proven this in recent court cases regarding Arizona's immigration laws, right? It's very clear that the national government has the ability and the power to and authority to regulate who comes into the country and who exits, right? That's not a state-level responsibility. So the national government here is clearly the one that is the decision maker. They have the authority and the power to do that. However, there are aspects things that governors can control that will make it more difficult. And I think that the governors here are essentially saying, look, let's take a statement. Let's make a statement that's going to be very popular politically. It's going to be difficult for us to actually implement this, right, because of our limited powers that we have over the immigration policy make it difficult for us to actually control who comes in and out of our states, whether or not the United States as a whole is accepting refugees or not. But we can make certain aspects more difficult. And this is kind of a classic battle of dual federalism, that the states have some responsibility for some of these aspects that are necessary in the process of resettling refugees. But the national government ultimately has ultimate authority here. And so this is kind of a classic example of federalism in the United States, where different sources of government have different levels of authority over certain aspects of a particular policy.
This
is federalism at work right here, is what we have.
You say this is politically popular among Republicans especially, but we're also seeing here that it may not be popular with one part of the Republican support. Let's listen to this. Reverend Alejandro Alfaro Santiz, he's a minister at Wesley United Methodist Church and Las Americas United Methodist Faith Community in Des Moines. He was one of several faith leaders who gathered this week in Des Moines to ask Governor Brandstad to accept refugees in Iowa, Syrian refugees. He says it's important to remember that Jesus was a refugee fleeing persecution in the Middle East.
We call our governor, who self-identifies as Christian, to follow Christ. We call our governor to do not turn away refugees, because as we all know, Iowa is welcoming.
Okay, so we remind ourselves last week the governor directed state agencies not to prepare for Syrian refugee settlement. Brandstad said he would be open to the idea if Congress passed a bill tightening security measures. Wayne, let me turn to you. This is interesting. We have evangelical Christians as well as more Christians more broadly, a core group in the Republican electoral base, but are among the most passionate advocates for aiding refugees.
Right, and they have been for a long period of time, and I think this is creating a real conflict in a lot of people's minds, the sense of welcoming to refugees to America, integrating them into our society, versus the fears on the other hand, and I'm glad to see that there's some blowback to the initial security threats that have been seen. I think there's a huge problem here, underlying problem, and I think the administration could have done something more earlier to let the country know what our refugee screening procedures are. I think a lot of people think our procedures are the same as those in Europe, and in fact, Europe has almost no screening procedures. The United States has very strict procedures.
Mm-hmm. Hans, your thoughts on this?
Well, this is a good example of, you know, where are people going to get their information, right? Yes, right. The Republican Party is and the Democratic Party are coalitions of different interests, right? On the Republican side, you've got fiscal conservatives, you've got defense hawks, you've got social conservatives, and nothing, right? Independently, there's nothing that says that a social conservative should necessarily unilaterally support a strong defense, right? Those things are not necessarily clearly linked. However, in American politics, those things are linked. And so as a result, this coalition depends upon the interplay between these particular groups, the trade-offs of one group being willing to say, yeah, I'm willing to support this other particular group in their policy aims because it will help me advance my policy aims as well, right? It's I'll scratch your back, you scratch mine, right? The nature of parties is that they're coalitions of interest that have become aligned.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we've got here is we've hit on a nerve that for some particular groups in that interest is a dividing line. It's a line of cleavage within the party. How strong this line of cleavage is, I think is going to be interesting to see, right? I think that, right, the individuals that within the Republican Party that are advocating this are individuals of faith. How much sway do they have over their congregations? How much sway do they have in the face of, you know, the vast majority of Republican candidates who have said, no, we need to limit the number of refugees that are coming into the country. Right. So this is kind of a classic, this might be a good example of trying to figure out where people are getting their information. When they are pressured by two groups that they agree with to do two different things, what happens? Where's the priority? My bet in politics is the politicians are going to have a larger sway, right? Leaders there's been studies that have shown that leaders are very able to persuade individuals to their particular point of view.
So you're saying politics over faith in this case?
I think that that's right. This is an issue of politics, not an issue of faith, right? This is what the government's doing. It's become a political issue. People of faith are concerned about it, right? Because they make up part of this political coalition. But I think that the political coalition in this case is going to demand essentially that individuals get in line with a specific political party. There are lots of people that will not, that will say, no, this is something that I'm going to disagree with my party on. But partisanship, I think, for a lot of people is a much stronger cue in terms of what positions they should take politically than is your religion, right? Your religion influences how you behave on an individual level, but it's not quite as clear that it has as strong an influence on your policy views as does your party adherence for most Americans, right? There are obviously exceptions here, but for most Americans, your political party has a stronger influence on your political views than your individual faith does.
Join our conversation with Hans Hassel and Wayne Moyer. Do you hear things you agree with, disagree with? What's your view on the questions about the war with ISIS, also the refugees that mostly Europe is encountering? Here in the United States, we're wrestling with that question. 1-866-780-9100, river to river. At iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. I was in the same room a few days ago with Rick Santorum, by no means someone at the top of the polls in the Republican column, Wayne, but his message to those in the room on the stump was that we should not, and this is one someone appealing to the evangelical Christian vote, though a Catholic, that we should not accept these refugees because by accepting them, we would be pulling the moderates out of those areas of the world, and ISIS would be only too happy to have the moderates leave so they could create their caliphate. What do you make of that reasoning?
Well, I'm not sure. I don't think there's any evidence to support that. People are leaving because their homes have been bombed, because life is unlivable. My sense would be it's a cross section of countries that are leaving. I've never seen any evidence that it's just moderate people who are leaving. Certainly ISIS has driven some people out. But ISIS's main strength is coming from people that they've brought in from the outside into their countries, and so I haven't seen any evidence in support of what Santorum's saying.
Okay, we'll come back and we'll talk about the latest Quinnipiac polls. Quinnipiac University just out with two new polls of likely Iowa caucus goers, GOP and Democratic caucus goers. We'll find out if there's been movement there on either side. There has, in fact. Ted Cruz showing a surge. We'll tell you about that when we come back. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. We're on Facebook, Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page, or tweet us at IPR Talk. We'll be back with more Wayne Moyer and Hans Hassel of Cornell College. Wayne of Grinnell College, our political analysts on this Politics Wednesday. Stay tuned. It's a Thanksgiving Eve edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Wayne Moyer is with us of Grinnell College, where he is the Rosenfield Professor of Political Science. Hans Hassel, Assistant Professor of Politics at Cornell College, two of our many political analysts we like to invite in on Wednesday to survey the political landscape of recent days. And we have been talking about the fears caused by international developments. We have various things going on. The Paris attacks, of course, the shoot down of the Russian plane yesterday by the Turkish military. Join us with your questions. about the war on ISIS, about the impact it has on our domestic politics. 1-866-780-9100. Also, talking about the refugee crisis. Of course, millions of refugees flooding out of the war-torn areas, many of them to Europe, but some of them to the United States. And now controversy here over whether we should be accepting Syrian refugees, with 30 governors of United States saying that they, including Governor Branstad, say he should not be coming to Iowa. Let's tackle this email from Dan, one of our listeners. I'm confused. Why aren't governors and states allowed to question immigration policy, but cities like Iowa City are allowed to violate the Constitution by declaring themselves sanctuary cities and refusing to cooperate with immigration authorities? Hans, can you react to that?
Yeah, so this is exactly the case of who's responsible for what in U.S. politics. So when we talk about sanctuary cities, what that generally means is that the city has directed its police force, right, the police force that the city controls, to not ask about immigration papers when they are arresting people. Right? So they're not that's something that the city says immigration is not our responsibility. We're not even going to ask about it, and we're not going to communicate this information to the federal government to take control of a situation if there's an immigrant there. So that's what the city, when we talk about sanctuary cities, that's essentially what we're talking about. The city is exercising its own control and its ability to control its police force, and by directing them not to question, not to ask questions about immigration.
And that's not a violation of the Constitution.
Not a violation. That's their police force that they're allowed to do what that police force and enforce local city laws. There are certain things that they're mandated to report, right? Violations of federal laws, some of the things like that that there are. But immigration, I believe, is not one of those things that they're mandated to report. And so this is an example of different responsibilities for different levels of government. The state government don't have any control over immigration policy. They can't say we don't want anyone from a certain country coming into the United States, right? Because that's not the state government's responsibility. That's the federal government's responsibility. That's the reason why when we go from Iowa to Nebraska for the big football game this weekend, we don't have to go through a checkpoint, right? We don't have to go through we don't have to present immigration papers when we go to Nebraska to watch Iowa beat Nebraska, right? It's that process. It's not the state's responsibility. We've essentially given that responsibility to the national government.
Let's go to John in Indianola. John dialed toll-free 1-866-780-9100. Hi, John. What's on your mind in this context?
Well, I'm wondering why Americans, and primarily the president of the Democratic Party, think we ought to bring in people that do not share Western cultures and values. And to be more specific, they call Christians infidels, they subjugate women, and then what are we going to do when you have some 40-year-old man that comes into the country married to a 14-year-old girl with a couple of kids? Because that's their cultural values, but not ours. And I'd like to know what your guests think about that.
Okay, John in Indianola, thank you very much. Wayne, how do you react to that comment?
Well, my sense is that most of the immigrants who are coming in are probably not very political. They are probably not fervently or zealously religious. They're people who have been deprived of their homes, who've been deprived of their wealth, in some cases deprived of their families. Should we not welcome people like this? There are some, of course, who are political. There are some who are zealots. There are some who will not integrate into American society. But our experience historically in the United States, most recently in Vietnam, another very different culture, is that they have integrated well into our society.
Okay, John. Anything to add to that, Hans?
Yeah, no. So this, I think that John's comment is very interesting in terms of the context that we think of when we have a perceived threat. There were some very, very interesting studies released shortly after 9/11 by some political psychologists and other people studying psychology that looked at how do our attitudes change when we are in a situation where death and our own mortality is more salient? And they found, one of the things that's absolutely fascinating that they found is that people start privileging their own experience and their own ethnic group, right? We may be a country that prides ourselves on diversity or prides ourselves on, you know, being tolerant of others and trying to work together, right? The adage of the United States being a melting pot of different ethnicities and different groups, or people working together to, right, to come from a wide variety of backgrounds. But in situations where we are, where we're reminded of our own mortality and we have this perception of threat, we are much more likely to privilege our own people that look like us, people that talk like us, right, our own group in ways that we wouldn't otherwise. And that's so. This is exactly what's going on. We, because of this threat, we're afraid of the threat that terror might present to us. And so, as a result of that, we look beyond the things that really matter, which are these good people that we can get along with? Are these people that are going to work and edify society? Are these people that are going to contribute? And we start thinking about, right, what's their religion? What's the color of their skin? Like, those things become more salient, and we become more focused on kind of benefiting and privileging those people that look like us.
John in Indianola, thank you for that question. Let's move to Hayes in Carroll, in the west central part of the state, Carroll, Iowa. Hayes, how are you?
Well, yourself?
Fine. What do you got for us?
Well, kind of along the lines of what your last caller was just talking about, I certainly think it's reasonable for people to be, you know, afraid or skeptical, and it's certainly reasonable for governors to, you know, review the programs that bring these people in. But the comments of some of our Republican governors, as a Republican myself, and your last caller, frankly, it's disgusting and it's abhorrent to me that we would, thanks to our privileged position in this world, turn these people away. That's what our country was founded upon. That's what we are morally obligated to do. Just because we're afraid of people doesn't mean that we can turn them away.
And what about John's point, though, that why welcome people into this country who don't share our Western ideals?
Well, we have people here who don't share our Western ideals. It's not a requirement to be a United States citizen that you share our ideals, that you're a Christian or that you're a conservative. I mean, we all have different viewpoints. That's certainly not a reason to turn someone away. Sure, you can be skeptical about the program and make sure that you do your due diligence, but to turn someone away carte blanche because they're different from you is just, it's disgusting to me. And I am so turned off by the political conversations around this. I'm embarrassed to be an American and hear conversations like this when our friends to the north, Canadians, are doing more.
Mm-hmm. Hayes, quickly, before we say goodbye to you, you identified yourself as a Republican. So this is where there's controversy in the Republican ranks, the Democratic ranks. They are unified in welcoming Syrian refugees. But what do you make of what the candidates on the GOP side have? And will you be caucusing for Republicans? Will this make a big part of your decision who you caucus for?
Absolutely. I'm not going to say who I will support or won't support because my mind isn't made up. But I think that the Republican establishment takes issues like this and they turn them into a political matter when they really shouldn't be. I mean, yes, should we have the review of our programs, bringing these people in, making sure that we're doing due diligence on them? Absolutely, that's very reasonable. But to make this a political issue and get people afraid and fired up about bringing immigrants into our country, people like your last caller right before me, you're making people afraid and you're just fueling the fire of intolerance, and that is so counter to the entire principle of what our republic stands for.
Okay.
It doesn't make any sense to me.
Hayes, thank you very much for calling from Carol, 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to these poll numbers. Our hour getting away from us. The new Quinnipiac University polls, two new polls out this week of likely Iowa caucus goers from each of the major parties. Let's look at the GOP side. Ted Cruz now essentially deadlocked with longtime poll leader Donald Trump in Iowa. Trump at 25%, Cruz at 23%. That is, though, within the margin of error. It's more than double what Cruz's standing was on October 22nd during that last Quinnipiac poll. It follows a Sunday survey released by CBS and YouGov that placed Cruz in second place in Iowa, 21% trailing Trump, but beating previous Iowa leader Ben Carson. I want to ask each of you, Hans and Wayne, what do you see in these numbers? Hans, you start off.
Oh, a couple of things. So the studies that I referenced just recently talked about how I said death and mortality salience causes people to change their position. The other aspect of this study was that I thought was really interesting was that it also shows that people change in their preferences of what type of candidates they're interested in. Are they interested in someone who's focused on a relationship, right? Ben Carson's relationship or the way that he relates to people is a very casual kind of friend-esque type way. You contrast that to someone like Ted Cruz or especially Donald Trump, who is a very bombastic type of personality. These studies found that death-haunted people were much more likely to prefer charismatic leaders as opposed to people that are relationship-oriented or task-oriented. So, right, the shift in the polls, I think, actually mirrors very well these studies that say what happens when threat and salience are on our minds here. And what you see is, right, the decline of those people those candidates that are perhaps are more relationship oriented and a turn to people that are more charismatic.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's listen to Ted Cruz since he's surged in the polls. This is Ted Cruz with CNN host Dana Bash. Dana Bash asking the Texas senator and presidential candidate Cruz on Monday whether he supports accepting refugees from Syria. Cruz says President Obama's current plan is lunacy.
What Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are proposing is that we bring to this country tens of thousands of Syrian Muslim refugees. I have to say, particularly in light of what happened in Paris, that's nothing short of lunacy.
What would have happened if your father was trying to get from Cuba to the United States and the political leaders here said, nope, we don't think so, because who knows, maybe you could be somebody who could, you know, commit crimes against America.
Well, see, that's why it's important to define what it is we're fighting. If my father were part of a theocratic and political movement like radical Islamism that promotes murdering anyone who doesn't share your extreme faith or forcibly converting them, then it would make perfect sense.
Wayne Moyer, how do you see Ted Cruz's ascent in the various recent polls?
Well, I think it's directly related to the decline of Ben Carson. Ben Carson has shown that he is really not up very much on international affairs in general. He's been wrong in his facts sometimes, even that China is involved in the Syrian struggle, which is not the case, or there's no evidence for it. And plus the fact that he does not come across as a really strong candidate in terms of being tough. And I think the ISIS situation is calling for tough candidates. And so Cruz is appealing to the same constituency as Carson was, the religious right. And I think as Carson fades, Cruz will continue to rise.
Okay, let's listen to a little bit of Ben Carson speaking in Wilton, Iowa this week. The presidential candidate and former brain neurosurgeon, Ben Carson, he's saying he's tired of people not taking him seriously when it comes to foreign policy.
First thing, and a thing that I've said for multiple months, is that if we take the fight to them over there, we're much less likely to have to fight them over here. And, you know, I find it a little frustrating when I say things like that, and nobody ever pays any attention. And they say, Carson doesn't know anything about foreign affairs, and yet everybody picks up on all the stuff that I say, including President Obama, and start using it themselves. I think it's very, very strange.
Okay, we've got a few more minutes. Let's go to other callers. Sylvia in Des Moines, thanks for waiting, and please be brief with your comment or question. We're running a little bit short of time.
Yeah, I have a question about the refugees. Apparently there's about 800,000 that are males, and they're going to be sitting in refugee camps waiting to come into various countries for a year or two. Why can't we draft those males and send them to boot camp for 6 to 8 weeks, have a coalition of military advisors from different countries, and then send them to fight for their own country? Why do we have to send an 18-year-old from Des Moines to go and get maimed or killed on their behalf when they're running away from their own country?
Okay. Wayne Moyer?
Well, in terms of, I guess the question is, the refugees are already in huge refugee camps in Turkey and in Jordan. And do we want to move them to huge refugee camps in our country or in other countries? And then which countries and how many refugees do you put where? I don't think we want to move these people any more than we have to move them. You don't want to go from one place to another, to another, to another. I agree that we need to do something as we're screening the refugees, but I'm not sure the camp strategy is the right one.
Mm-hmm. Sylvia, are you still there?
Yeah, I think that's just detail.
Mm-hmm.
For example, it's going to cost hundreds of thousands, probably billions of dollars to get them all over here. They're going to be sitting in refugee camps for a couple years, just living off of charity and government. Get them prepared to fight and send them back over and say, it's your country, take it back.
I think that's a nice thought. I mean, you look at the opposition right now to refugees coming into the country because we're afraid that some of them might be radicalized in some way, right? Can you imagine the opposition that would arise out of this if we said, oh, we're not only going to immigrate, we're going to immigrate them, we're also going to give them guns and weapons. At the same time,
I think there would be
a pushback about this.
We're not even bringing them here.
They would be at the same time working with U.S. forces. We would have to train them, right? Essentially, that's the problem, right? If we want to be sure that the people that we're asking to fight these battles are people we can trust, and I think the main concern with immigration right now is that we don't trust these people.
If you don't trust them, why are we bringing them here? Because I guarantee you, if they won't fight for their own country, they're not going to fight for their adopted country either.
Most of these immigrants are women and children, and I don't think they're going to be in a position where they can really fight.
Okay, thank you, Sylvia, for that call from Des Moines. Let's hear from the leader still in the GOP column for 4 months now. Every week, something that makes it into the headlines is controversial. Donald Trump's latest claims are that he watched people jump from the Twin Towers, that people were partying as people jumped from the Twin Towers and as the towers collapsed. Here's what he had to say in Jersey City.
Holding tailgate style. Tailgate. You know what that means? Tailgate. That means football games, Ohio State, thousands of people in parking lots, on roofs.
Okay, that not speaking from Jersey City, he was talking about Jersey City. Let's have a quick comment before we have to end this show. Hans Hassel, about Donald Trump predictions as foreign policy comes to the fore here.
This is the thing that conspiracy theories are made of, right? This is right. You get a conspiracy theory spouted out by someone in the mainstream media. It's picked up, or no, not someone in the mainstream media, some major political figure. It's picked up, and this is problematic. This is very problematic.
Mm-hmm. Wayne Moyer,
this may help Trump in the short term, but it's clearly untrue. And in the long term, I can't see anything but that it will hurt him.
Comparing Trump with Carson, perhaps taking a hit in the polls because of his lack of foreign policy credentials, depth, is Donald Trump resilient there? Does he have more foreign policy depth, Wayne?
No, but he's tough. He sounds tough. He's a strong man, and I think when there is a threat, people want a strong leader, and Trump comes across as a person who will be strong and who will be decisive. And that takes the place of knowing anything about what's actually happening.
Okay. On the Democratic side, quickly before we have to go, the latest Quinnipiac University poll released this morning, very steady there. Clinton receiving 51% of support in the latest survey, unchanged from the October poll. Bernie Sanders taking 42%, a slight increase of 2 points. Former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley just 4%. So no change there. Well, we've come to the end of our Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Thanks to Hans Hassel, Assistant Professor of Politics at Cornell College, and Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Always great to have you two on our program, and we wish you and all of our listeners a happy Thanksgiving. Thank you, Wayne and Hans.
Happy Thanksgiving to you too, Ben.
Happy Thanksgiving.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow on the program, special Thanksgiving Day programming, Turkey Confidential, starting at 11 o'clock. Hope you'll tune in for that with Lynn Rosetto Casper. Executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.